Good morning.
Good morning.
Please the court, my name is Robert Heller. I'm appearing on behalf of the appellant in this matter, Kathy Stevens. My materials.
Would you like to reserve some time for
rebuttal? I'm sorry. Please, 2 minutes. Thank you. I won't go into too much detail based on the materials we previously filed in this matter. The three prongs that we're looking at here initially are whether this court can consider the jury instruction to which we have briefed our case based on the compliance and noncompliance with Civil Rule 51F. The second is whether the verdict was supported by substantial evidence. And the third is whether the trial court was in error in not granting a new trial. I think we probably should address the jury instruction question first because when we review the record, it is clear that there was not a specific objection stated in the record with regards to jury instruction number 15. 51F requires something clearer with regards to what is the basis of the objection and what is the instruction to which it objected. We know that. As was noted in our materials, there was no court reporter in the room when the arguments were made on this or when the exceptions were taken. They were taken into the minutes of the proceeding. I misunderstood and assumed that there was going to be a little bit more detail in there than there was, but regardless, if we stop right there, I would have to agree that there is insufficient information in the record for this court to consider that instruction. However, the Attorney General's office provided the assistance we needed to get this clarified by filing a brief in response to the issues that were presented, which detailed the department's position regarding the use of that particular instruction in a case such as this. This has the effect, when taken in conjunction with the plaintiff's exceptions being taken, the brief being submitted addressing the issues that were before the court in the jury instruction selection period, defines what was going on in there. There was an argument. This is what it's about. This is the case. This is the instruction we're having trouble with. And this is, and from their perspective, this is why you should allow that instruction. I think what that establishes is what the memo court was looking at when it said, even if you don't specifically comply with the rules, as long as the trial court has been provided sufficient information to be fully advised on the concerns of the parties, and that's reflected in the record, then this court has the authority to consider whether that instruction was properly admitted to the jury room. And in this case, that's significant, because the instruction that we're referring to was an instruction which conflated two different areas of law, the medical probability, proving a case on a more probable than not basis, medical testimony has to be on a more probable than not basis, and the question of proximate cause. It's well established in workers' compensation law that the burden is on the claimant to establish that their condition, that the conditions complained of were a proximate cause of the conditions complained of. And there is a separate instruction in the jury instructions regarding the use of regarding multiple proximate causes. There can be more than one proximate cause. It's not the proximate cause. It is a proximate cause. The jury was given the this instruction, which states at the very beginning, I can read it, the Stevens condition and the proximate cause of that condition must be established by medical evidence. Well, the jury, we can tell that this is going to be confusing to the jury because it misstates the law. There is nowhere in the law that says the claimant has to prove the proximate cause of a condition. It only and always has the burden of proving a proximate cause. We know this was confusing to the jury because the jury sent out multiple written requests in the record asking for clarification on this issue of proximate cause. There were three separate inquiries to which, unfortunately, the only thing the judge could do was send back a note saying, refer to your jury instructions, which isn't helping them because the jury instructions are what's confusing them in the first place.
One standard that's applied is whether an individual has the opportunity to argue their theory of the case under all the instructions. Why weren't you able to argue your theory of the case under Instruction 12?
Well, we did. We argued our theory of the case under half of question of jury Instruction 12, which is we agree that there has to be a more probable than not basis medically for a proximate cause, and we argued from the others.
Not 15. I think you're talking about.
Oh, I'm sorry. You're talking about 15 meaning the multiple proximate cause. We made the effort to do that, and we did point them, directed them specifically to 12, but. Because there was, now this is what I'm saying, if you look at the records with the inquiries that were sent out, because there are conflicting mentions of a proximate cause and the proximate cause, and specifically the proximate cause in the context of medical testimony, they became just muddled back there. And it became clear that they were muddled every time they sent out another inquiry. Had that instruction included the language a proximate cause at the beginning of the instruction rather than the proximate cause, I would say our position is less strong, but didn't. I should jump to another point, but I think because of that, that instruction was erroneous by law and should never have been given. And we would like to, and on that basis alone, we believe that we are entitled to a new trial in this matter. But the second point is the substantial evidence question. And we're not asking this court.
Before you get there, yes. Is the record clear that you objected to the instructions?
The record is clear that we noted exceptions and objections to the instructions, but it was a very general note, which is why I say if we were just relying on the note in the record, that we wouldn't be here. But when the department then filed their brief in response, the point of memo is whether the trial court had sufficient basis to understand what was at stake. And we believe that that establishes that the discussions had taken place and was formally advised of their position with regards to what had taken place. And that fulfills the requirements of memo.
Thank you.
With regards to substantial evidence position. I went back and took a look at some of the other cases that predated the cases which talk about that this court cannot invade the province of the jury. And I was looking for the language that most clearly states that, and I found the Hellman versus Sacred Heart, which is a Supreme Court case 63-136, 1963, and what it says is that the substantial evidence means evidence in sufficient quantity to persuade a fair-minded individual, rational person, the truth of the matter declared, the declared premise. But it also says that the court is not in a position to weigh the entire case, to go through the whole weighing of all the evidence. You're only looking at to see if there's substantial evidence to support the position proposed by one of the parties. I would suggest that requires you to do some weighing, and that's weighing the evidence of Dr. Cox, because that was the only evidence that was presented that was the basis for the department's case. You have to do some weighing involved there to determine if there's substantial evidence, and I believe in weighing that, you see that Dr. Cox's testimony was based on speculation, circumstantial evidence, and a total misunderstanding of the claimant's job. Thank you.
Thank you. May it please the court, I'm Anastasia Sandstrom, Assistant Attorney General, and I represent the Department of Labor and Industries. A jury rejected Ms. Stevens' claim of occupational disease, and this court should affirm for three reasons. First, Ms. Stevens has not preserved her error with respect to her jury instructions because she did not ensure that a court reporter was present. Second, the instruction number 15 correctly states the law regarding the need for medical testimony to be stated in terms of probability, not possibility, and the jury was instructed about multiple proximate causes. And third, Ms. Stevens' arguments with respect to Dr. Cox reweigh the evidence. The jury heard her concerns and rejected them, substantial evidence supports their verdict.
Looking at your brief in response to their objections, does it not adequately indicate the objection was to the proximate cause portion of the instruction?
Well, the department, what happened in the time frame was.
And can't we rely on that of the record to say we properly reached the issue?
That brief does not address the precise nature of their objection. First, there was a conference about the jury instructions. Then the department files the brief. Then there's the objections made by counsel. We don't know what that objection was made by counsel. We don't know what he said. It's not in the record. And the RAPs require that be recorded, so we know the exact words that they cite. And the reason why this is important is because in his brief at page 8, in his brief at reply brief at page 6, he says the reason why the instruction shouldn't have been given is because it was confusing to the jury. However, now he argues that the reason why the instruction shouldn't have been given to the jury is because it says the proximate cause, not a proximate cause. But there's no record that argument was made to the trial court. And certainly the policy behind Civil Rule 51 is to allow the trial court the opportunity to fix, so we don't have an argument made months after the trial was over that a jury's verdict should be overturned because of the use of one word. That is a sort of wording choice that can be fixed by a trial court. There's no evidence that was argued to the trial court, but certainly the trial court could have fixed it if it was a problem.
And so your brief preceded the objections and could not have been responsive to the objections.
Right. I think there was a general conference, then the brief, then the objections. And there is a procedure under the RAPs for an agreed record of proceedings to happen that would allow if there was some sort of technological problem with the record. That didn't occur here. There's no argument that they couldn't have had a court reporter. With respect to the jury instruction, the court in Bryant specifically said that when there was an instruction that said the proximate cause, there was an argument that meant that there could only be one proximate cause. And the court said there was an instruction given that there could be multiple proximate cause, and the jury was to read these instructions together, and there was no error. So here, even if you assume there was an error, and the department doesn't think there was, the fact that there is an instruction about multiple proximate cause allowed all parties to argue their theory of the case. Jury instructions are read together, and there was no error. And I would say that there's no confusion to the jury. The jury's instructed that the work conditions must proximately cause the medical condition. They're instructed that there can be more than one proximate cause of that condition, and that any such condition must be proven by medical testimony that's expressed in terms of probability, not possibility. With respect to the substantial evidence argument, Ms. Stevens asked this court to reweigh the evidence. But Dr. Cox testified that her asthma was caused by smoking, not by occupational exposure. The jury could rely upon that testimony and believe Dr. Cox. Dr. Cox was asked if he was aware that the sanding table was not operating on the day that the hygienist visited. He said he was. The claimant, Ms. Stevens, told him he was aware of that, and it did not change his opinion. Counsel asked him a number of questions that he was trying to show undermined the credibility of Dr. Cox's opinion. Dr. Cox said they did not matter. It should be noted that Dr. Cox also pointed out that Ms. Stevens' condition did not improve when she left the exposure, according to medical records that he had. And it is a tenet of occupational disease that someone's condition would improve when they leave. He also testified that she had smoked for 19 years, and it was his opinion that her internal clock had run, that it was time for her to have problems, and that she did. The jury was entitled to believe that, to weigh the credibility with respect to his testimony, to look to see whether they agreed with him, whether they agreed with the doctors. They chose to believe Dr. Cox. The jury verdict is supported by substantial evidence, and this court should affirm. Unless there's any more questions.
Thank you.
Minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Honor.
Do you agree that the brief was filed before formal objections were taken?
The argument was made in colloquy with regards to the conditions, and then following that, the Attorney General presented the brief at the beginning of the taking the form was when the judge would take exceptions. With regards to, I could jump in with regards to Dr. Cox, since that's where I left off a moment ago. Dr. Cox is a very knowledgeable man in the area of pulmonology, and he has his ideas of what's important about asthma and smoking, which I think I would agree with. But however, Dr. Cox was established through the cross-examination. He was brought in for one reason, and that was to determine that the what was the causation relationship between her exposure at work and the aggravation of her breathing condition. He can say everything he wants about asthma, but he had to address, for purposes of this case, a seminal issue, which was, did her work exposures have an effect on her breathing conditions? And he specifically identified that he did not know what she was exposed to, when she was exposed to it, how long she was exposed to it, in what quantity was it in the air where she worked. Was there any in the air where she worked? He didn't know anything like that. So he offered an opinion as to the effect of her job exposure on her asthma without knowing what her job exposure was. And to that extent, it's sheer circumstantial evidence, and it's an opinion based on circumstantial evidence, and it's pure speculation. In that same case, Hellman stated that I mentioned before, that a verdict may not be founded on theory or speculation. And that's all he did. He may be brilliant on smoking and asthma, but on the issue of this case, he missed the boat entirely because he didn't know what her job was, but he was willing to offer an opinion on it. That's why it was not substantial evidence. Thank you. We ask for it to be reversed.
Thank you both very much.